Item 401.
The assessment accountability pilot. The next item is presentation on assessment and accountability. Commissioner?
Thank you. What started this whole conversation was the rural agility pilot and what they presented to you today. We just wanted Elliot, who's been working with the group, to follow up on a few things that expand beyond the discussion and answer any questions, and then we'll go on. Elliot?
Great. Madam Chair?
Yes.
It's very timely to have our rural colleagues with us this morning. We've had a number of conversations with them over the last several months about their project, and we've been in conversation with a number of states over the past year or so who are looking at alternative accountability systems, California, Vermont, Tennessee, Kentucky, and in particular New Hampshire, who just received a waiver earlier this year from the U.S. Department of Education to engage in an alternative assessment, alternative assessment accountability system. So we even, as you know, in our waiver application to renew our waiver with USDOE, we included some language that we intended to come forward with a proposal to USDOE to get their okay to move into an alternative accountability pilot. And we've done some work as well with our rural Innovation Alliance friends around what is possible. In fact, the slides that I'm sharing with you today, they've already seen, and we had a chance to talk about some in terms of what they would mean, and as we're talking about this with you. So basically what I'd like to do is just spend a little time giving you some context about some of the issues that came up during their presentation, and I'll apologize ahead of time as a result of the legislature and also discussions with some of the folks who presented. We've made some changes in the slides that we originally gave you, and I think you've got a new copy just this morning, so I'm sorry for newness. The concepts are still the same. Some of the language has changed a bit. So I just want to take a minute to talk about accountability in Colorado and kind of how we got this place, and then provide some way of thinking about how we can move to a different kind of accountability system, and then give you some ideas about what we expect will be some of the either barriers or issues that we'll need to deal with as we move forward with this kind of thinking. And I'll obviously take your questions. Just quickly to remind you here, state accountability as we know it probably appeared in 1971. There was an Education Accountability Act that was passed then, but it was a very loose system of accountability, and the goals were that districts would engage in more planning using data and so on. There wasn't much to that system. The first real state accountability system emerged from the development of statewide standards and assessments, CSAP in particular, but it was really the Owens administration that put together these school accountability reports that were very specific. They were based on some work done in Texas, very specific about what was included, and they were distributed to parents with an idea that they would provide a lot more information for choice. At the same time, CDE started to develop something called a weighted index, which looked at results of from CSAP, and also the legislature started to act on the accountability system, and it became kind of, to be quite honest about it, it became a catch-all for every interest that legislators had, and it became a big checklist. So when somebody said, we like contextualized learning, I didn't know what that was when I was in a school district for a while, but I think it means career and tech ed now. We would have to have some evidence that we had a program of that, and somebody would add something else and something else, and then these reports would be written by folks from CDE would visit the district, and they'd write these reports, and some of those reports are very well done, and others were not as well done. It depended on the individual that visited us. At the same time, we had No Child Left Behind kind of emerge from the Bush administration. So at one time in Colorado, we had three different kinds of accountability systems. We actually had four. The three were the school accountability reports, these reports that were written about districts, and then also No Child Left Behind. And so what happened is we had schools and districts getting rated differently in each of those systems. You might have a school that was rated excellent on the school accountability report, was failing on a No Child Left Behind, and was kind of accredited, so to speak, by the review and reports. So in 2009, basically, The current accountability system was created to try to align those pieces, and also in our waiver in 2012, we tried to also align federal, ask for relief from the No Child Left Behind system, so we didn't have several different competing accountability systems, and the one that's currently in place with district and school performance frameworks was one that systematized the kinds of indicators that we were going to use to rate schools and districts across the state. Where we are now, if you count, if you can think of the accountability system kind of all together as accountability 1.0, and the school and district performance frameworks might be 1.5. I'm not real good at this software kind of numbering, but that's, you get the picture, right? That we're moving toward accountability 2.0. Right now we have an accountability work group that's looking at what we can do with the system we currently have, how that should be changed to make it more fair, even address some of the issues that we heard around the small end size and so on. A lot of those discussions are going on with a work group of about 30 people that you've heard about before. But we're also in the process of applying to the U.S. Department of Education for a waiver to do some things differently. And you might think of that as accountability 2.5. And the folks that we heard this morning are pushing us towards maybe what we might call a next generation of accountability, or a 3.0 piece, even though there may be further steps there. The commissioner charged Rebecca Holmes, our Associate Commissioner for Innovation and Choice, to lead some thinking about 3.0, and we've been doing some of that in the department, and we've had some convenings with various groups across the state. So another way to do this is to think about, we're at revising the school and district performance frameworks now. If we have an accountability pilot, it takes us a little farther. There's probably some things that remain from the old system, and we talked about some of those here that might have to do with comparability. And then eventually we'd move to a new concept depending on how those things worked, as you heard from the timeline that these folks have put out today about how to take a look at this system and think about how it's working, how it could be improved, and what it means for the rest of the state. So as we thought about applying to USDOE, here were the goals of that kind of came up with us, and they overlap a lot with what we heard earlier today. I think it's critical to reduce the emphasis on state assessment. We all know there's too much of it. We probably didn't get much relief from the law that just passed, and frankly, we worked along with our rural friends at trying to create some space in that legislation that would allow more of this kind of pilot piece, and we were very successful at that, as it turns out, and I know some of us are frustrated with that. But we also saw as a goal is to include locally scored common performance assessments. That's kind of the New Hampshire model, as well as just local assessments in the state assessment and accountability system, somewhat along the lines that these folks talked about, to provide a lot more timely information and useful data to inform instruction. Brian Hansen in particular was talking about the frustration of his teachers and not being able to get information back and having to wait, and it's not very useful information when it's 5-6 months old. We also wanted to see, though, a system that that really assesses application of student learning in real-life settings so that we could do these kinds of performance tasks that are engaging to kids, they give information to teachers on a timely basis, and so forth. A couple other pieces there that are important is this: continue to ensure equity and transparency so we can take a look at different gaps that are important to us, but also have some comparability across schools and districts. Dr. Schroeder addressed that earlier about there are folks that want to know how folks in Mancos are doing compared to folks in Marino and so on. So I'm going to do this real fast, but there's a lot of political and philosophical backing for these kinds of systems, but there's also some technical pieces that help us make an argument around why we should move to a more integrated kind of assessment, and then that allows us to have a more, I think, robust and interesting accountability system. So bear with me, I'll do this fast. There's two big dimensions of assessment to think about with this. One has to do with the degree to which assessments are standardized. When they're any kind of large scale, you have to standardize them like crazy. There's too many variables inside, and you can't make sense of why there's differences. But teachers, they give unstandardized assessments all the time in classrooms. Okay? Sometimes they do standardized ones, too, but they'll say, Elliot, why don't you just take this home and work on it? It doesn't look like you're doing as well on this as you normally would, and come back, because they have all kinds of information they can bring to bear. A large-scale assessment person has one shot at this, basically. Okay? And the other dimension to think about here is how you answer the show what you know. Do you choose the answer all the way over to do you do the answer? Okay? When I say choose the answer, you take you answer a multiple choice question about the standards you're looking at, and do you answer? You actually do what you're talking about. It's hard to, in a large scale system, have people perform these pieces. But you and I would probably both agree that if we're flying out of DIA tonight, that I would want to have the pilot that took actually did the do part, not the one that took the multiple choice test. Okay, so some of these things are really important for us to look at. So what happens in large scale tests? A whole bunch of them get put up in the short answer, highly standardized place because they're cheap and fast and quick to do. Okay? But occasionally we've tried to move to, for important outcomes, to more of a performance piece. And you've seen that in writing tests in particular, the performance-based pieces of PARC and so on. But they're hard to do and they take a lot of time. And PARC tried it and it looks like it's taking too much time and energy away from these pieces that could be done very easily. Much easier at the classroom. So the kinds of things that teachers can do can be even more unstandardized and less obtrusive if we're clever about how we put these in a system. And so technically we have to think about how that works, because once you try to standardize some things like a literacy portfolio or a science fair project and use it at the state level, sometimes you kill it. That's what happened in Vermont when they tried to use mathematics and literacy portfolios. Thought it was going to be a good idea. They couldn't pull it off, and they had to constrict it so much that kids didn't get to choose. The kind of engagement that you see kids display with these pieces got destroyed. So if we can think about how to be clever about using some of these more performance-based pieces in an accountability system, it starts to get at what our friends were talking about here. But there's some guardrails that we have to deal with that we think are going to be in the federal waiver proposal process that we ask for permission to do these things. Okay? This is a list of probable ones based on what we know from New Hampshire and others, but there's a couple key ones that you heard come up earlier. One is that they're going to require some annual reporting on achievement and growth toward post-secondary and workforce readiness for every student in specific grades, for students that are involved in the assessment system. That's probably going to be something that some folks in Colorado are going to want to see too, whether it's off a specific state test or more of a body of evidence kind of approach. Folks are going to want to know, how's my student doing? A second one is also annual determinations for each school and district. That requires some sort of comparability across schools and districts and some sort of being able to see how well a school and district is performing compared to others. And there's probably also a continued commitment to equity and disaggregated reporting, being able to talk about how different groups are doing. That becomes difficult with small school districts, and so that's going to continue to require a lot of work. The other pieces that we think might show up in some federal requirements, or they'd ask us to negotiate with them, have a lot to do already with what these folks are advocating. Things like diagnostic reviews, building district capacity to understand and use assessments in a realistic way. Providing support and intervention for low-performing schools and learning from the ones that are high-performing. And what's really interesting that we saw in the New Hampshire application was that you need to take a look and see if these systems work, and if they do, you need to have a plan for scaling them up so that folks can all folks across your state can have the opportunity to engage in this kind of system. Fits very much with what we've heard from these folks, but there are a couple of technical guardrails like the comparability and annual reporting and so on that we need to deal with. So what could something like this look like? We took this from New Hampshire's model and just played with it a little bit based on some language from the recent state test. And basically, what you see is you might be able to say, let's do local assessments, for example, in some grades. Occasionally, you might have a bank of common assessments that people choose from that districts contributed to and that the state was able to validate as being assessments of the standards that we want. And then occasionally, and I left PARC in there because that's the test we have right now. That may change, and we understand that. So that occasionally you would give a statewide test to act as a check on the results from these local or common assessments that could provide an opportunity for comparability. Now, there's a lot of technical details inside of this idea, but this is one way of thinking about it. They brought up earlier some other ways of thinking about that might be sampling of every year of a certain test. But there's different ways to do this. New Hampshire got this kind of model approved. They did have to do some dual testing for a little bit with the districts that were involved. When I say a little bit, in the context of accountability, a little bit is probably a year or two. Okay.
Ellie.
Yeah.
I have to interrupt and point out what's missing in this file. What's missing? Social studies, right?
Yeah. And I just chose these two as what we had to do under federal requirements. I'm sorry.
Very representative of what's going on in Colorado. Yeah. Same thing, you know, and I continually have to bring that up and remind people that that's very important. Go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. No, that's fine. I use this as a model of what we'd have to submit to the federal government because USDOE doesn't require us to test in social studies. So...
Does it require social studies?
They don't require us to assess in social studies under the U.S. Department of Education, so that's why I use this. But your point is well taken. So the last piece are some possible next steps. We've been working with the Center for Assessment to draft a proposal that we could take out to other stakeholders. We worked with them because they were primarily responsible for helping New Hampshire get their proposal approved by the U.S. Department of Education, and we wanted to learn from that and see if we could speed this process up a little bit.
Excuse me. I'm sorry. Who did you say helped you? New Hampshire?
The National Center for Improvement of Educational Assessment. I'm sorry. I used the center. Thank you.
I just missed it.
And so we would see identifying some sort of pilot parameters. Some of this fits in with what we're going to have to figure out around 1323 as well. What does it mean to, what kind of evidence do you have to collect? How can we help districts do that? What would it need to identify capacity needs and provide technical support, as Mr. Bissonnette referred to earlier? And then move forward to submit this plan and then try to work on the assessment pieces as we go along. That's generally the kind of thinking that we've been doing up to this point and how we could start to take the ideas we heard here today and create some space for that to be happen here in Colorado. Are you happy to answer any questions you may have?
Jane? Has New Hampshire had in place a bank of assessments, or did they basically need to start from scratch on that part? I've read about this for a while, but I can't remember some of the details.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
They developed a bank of common assessments as part of this process. So they went out to districts themselves, and their piece is more top-down driven from a state perspective. And they said, who's interested in this idea? And they came together with about 15 districts initially. They have very small school districts. Ours are small, but they have almost uniformly very small districts. And folks worked on developing some of these assessments or identifying some that they're using, and they worked on them together. And we have some... we already have that kind of activity going on in Colorado. We could build on it, both from CDE as well as some districts that have come together to do that. And then some districts said, this is all we want to do. We're just going to stick with what we learned. We're going to use some of these assessments. Others said, we want to push further into this pilot piece. But they were able to develop a bank of assessments that districts could choose from.
Angelica?
Are you finished yet?
I think James.
Well, go ahead.
No. Jane, you got to talk faster. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No, I don't have to talk faster. I'm curious about, and I don't know that today's the time for this, about what the utilization rate has been for our current resource bank. Just in everyday classroom use, you know, if teachers are taking advantage. I realize that's not. That's not something you need to answer right now and find out. But we do. My point is, what do we already have in place that we need to keep in mind is a building block or two for a lot of this work as we go forward with this. In social studies, you know, we are at liberty. We are free to work that into however we wish. As part of our state system. And there was a bill that was passed that supplements mm-hmm. any interest and efforts to do that. So I just want to ease Marcia's fears that we're verging on forgetting social studies. But I'd be interested to know, I can talk with our other staff as well. I'd like to know, what are people using what we have available right now?
Madam Chair, I can't answer that question, but I will say that we have some structures in place, like our content collaboratives, for example, have done a lot of work. And a number of our BOCES have also sponsored some common assessment development where teachers are working together. Some of the districts that you heard present today have been involved in work with other districts doing that same kind of work. So there are structures that we could use.
Yeah, we attended one of those. Yeah. Jane?
Well, we at least, as a minimum of us, have seen some of that work in action, but the aftermath, since that time, how much are people aware of, taking advantage of, in the best way possible, of what we have worked up already as a state, which in my mind really is applicable to all sizes of districts. It's a content-based opportunity that... as we move forward, that we need to enhance and we need to make sure people are aware of what is available and accessible. Thanks, Ellen.
Angelica?
The New Hampshire model, I think it was, are those all online?
Madam Chair?
Yes.
I'm not sure. I'd have to see. Those assessments are given locally so that teachers embed them in a curriculum when it's appropriate for them. That's why they value them so much. Some of those are maybe online and use computers to a degree, but they're going to be more larger events than we can do at a statewide level. So this might be a task that goes on for several days, and kids have an opportunity to use a variety of different resources that may not be available to them in a state test because you have to standardize what everybody can use.
But I can find my fantasy all along has been that we are not where we will ultimately be with assessments, and that we will be able to use assessments that give immediate feedback to kids and teachers, but that somehow if they're online and secured, the state can pull the information to create the accountability piece. And I wish we could think about, I mean, I know that's technically getting kind of ahead of ourselves, but I think there are people out there who could imagine doing that, looking at the formative assessments that are agreed to among the educators in the state, and then finding a way to securely use those also ultimately to measure student growth and for accountability purposes.
Madam Chair? Certainly that's possible. A lot of districts use multiple choice tests right now in that way to get things back. I'm not
talking about multiple choice.
That's what I am.
Sorry.
Yes, so. Vermont actually is doing a couple of interesting pieces like that, and they're developing and talking about a new accountability system. I referred to a visit that I had an opportunity to go to several weeks ago where they're looking at what they're calling school reviews, and they do one annually that's data that's already collected from schools, some of its achievement, and they're expanding it to other areas. And then every 3 years, they're developing a review process similar to what our friends told us about earlier, where groups go to every school and they give them feedback. Some of it's quantitative, some of it's qualitative, some of it's the same for every district, and some of it's also driven by specific needs that a school or district would say, I want you to look for these things in our classrooms. So it's an interesting idea. That's part of the group that we've been working with to see how these pieces might work in Colorado.
Thanks.
Anybody else? Steve?
On the waiver process, do you generally get one waiver for everything in a year that you want, or is it, can you get a waiver for a specific project, or is it some combination of both?
Madam Chair, I'm going to just generally, I'd like to see if Dr. Owen would help me with this. Basically, we have one waiver from the requirements, and then we can make amendments to that. That's what this proposal would be, but.
Dr. Owen?
Madam Chair, that's correct.
Okay. So if our basic waiver is somehow denied, then we couldn't get this as a supplement. Is that a fair statement?
No.
Madam Chair, I think there could be possibilities of working directly with USDOE under NCLB that would allow you to request different flexibility outside of the waiver process. We haven't done that. I'm not sure how many other states have done that, but I think there's a way to do it. I don't know if they would be open to discussing flexibility when we haven't taken advantage of the waiver process, though, under NCLB. So it's hard to say, but I think I wouldn't close the door completely on the idea.
Finally, if how long until it becomes apparent that we'll either get a waiver for this or we won't, because these districts that appeared here are small and resource challenged, and for them to continue down a path, if this doesn't work and doesn't provide them some relief, is certainly not fair to them, and it's not a good use of our staff time either. So how long until we know whether we'll be able to serve them appropriately by obtaining a waiver that fits what they want to do?
Madam Chair? It's hard to answer that specifically, Mr. Durham. It's a great question. We think that we can finish our proposal here in the next several weeks, although we'd like to make sure that we have additional folks out in the field have a chance to weigh in on some of the aspects of that piece. And that's part of the process that we have stakeholder support. So we can submit it, we hope, within the next month. And then we'll know fairly soon if there are issues that we have to negotiate with. We can also have some conversations ahead of time. How long that negotiation process gets played out is difficult to determine, and I defer to Dr. Owen or the commissioner who have more experience with that than I have.
Madam Chair, I think that's right. The only thing I would add to what Dr. Ash said there was that under NCLB and under our current waiver is one process, but if ESEA is reauthorized, which we're still thinking maybe it's 50-50. That's kind of the estimates we're still hearing. So if that happens, there might be a process under ESEA for states to just do these types of activities. So that is a possibility if ESEA were to be reauthorized. Some of the drafts and some of the versions allow for states to design accountability pilots and assessment pilots. If we're operating under NCLB, then it's more like what Elliot described, and that's a process of negotiating, going back and forth, which is what New Hampshire did to get final approval on their pilot.
Madam Chair, just one other response.
Is that wrong?
Maybe incorporate it, but is it at all worthwhile trying to weigh in on this issue federally to see if we can get Congress to move in that direction of some flexibility, or is it a game well above our pay grade?
No. Madam Chair? Hey, it's a good question. I think we've always been willing to, when we get requests from senators and people working on the revisions to NCLB, to give input. We certainly look it over, and staff will provide their own feedback on specific areas where we've seen issues or challenges. Our ability as a state, though, to get pieces of the legislation move forward for reauthorization, I think we're being well served by our representatives trying their best to get that done. But I think they understand, at least our senator representatives, I think certainly understand the challenges that we've been having in the state and some of the issues that we've been working through as a state around the restrictions under NCLB and the waiver process that USDOE has put together. So I think they're advocating to try to get that reauthorization done. Could the state board collectively put pressure and want them to move in a direction of reauthorization? I think you could always help put your voice and your weight behind what you'd like to see done at the federal level as well. So I would think that they would take that into consideration and use that appropriately as well.
Madam Chair?
So we might do a resolution or something to send along with the...
Madam Chair, I think certainly the state board collectively could take a position on reauthorization and your desire to see reauthorization and the things that you'd like to see inside of reauthorization, and send that to the Colorado representative delegation.
Yes, Elliot.
The other point he said point out is much of what these folks have asked for and what we're contemplating in some of this work is they don't need permission to do. They can add things to their local accountability systems as they fit. It's the assessment pieces and how the school and district performance ratings impact them that will take some negotiation. But there's some pieces we could move forward with, Mr. Durham, for example, around school reviews and some other pieces help them in that regard. And we could also look at what technical assistance folks may need to think about these comparability issues and so on.
Commissioner, did you have something to add there?
No,
No, the only thing I'd add is a couple months ago when we were back in Washington, when the chiefs met with the secretary and with members of Congress, I mean, we were unanimous in we've got to have the flexibility. We need the law passed. We need the flexibility to allow pilots. And everybody's getting hung up on some of the small details, but the overall picture, I think there's good consensus on getting out there, getting approved with the flexibility. But you get down to a certain level, it stops. I think that's what makes us pretty frustrating. I do believe once it is passed, we'll have the flexibility to not have pilots.
Yeah.
But it is frustrating because I can't guarantee it's going to pass.
Yeah.
Madam Chair.
Oh. Thank you for getting us to speak about this issue. Can you just remind me where we are on the waiver? Did we submit a letter of intent that we are applying for a waiver, and is this the guts of what the waiver is, or is this a follow-up to the waiver we've submitted? Where are we with the waiver for NCLB?
Madam Chair?
Yes.
We have submitted a waiver, but I'll defer to Dr. Rowan on that.
Yeah.
Madam Chair, that's actually the next presentation up, is we're going to give you an update on where we're at with the waivers.
We've already asked for a waiver. Is that right?
So, Madam Chair? We have requested some amendments to our existing waiver, which expires at the end of June.
Okay.
So that's one piece that we talked to you guys about in March. And then we have, after you approved, we submitted a waiver renewal, which is for 3 years. That would be effective July, August, whenever USDOE gets to approving them. And that would be for a three-year period under NCLB. Again, if ESEA is reauthorized, then that waiver becomes a moot point. But we have submitted that today. I think actually the next presentation is kind of an update on where we're at with both of those processes.
But is the content of this PowerPoint what we're asking for in that waiver, or are we talking about what we're going to ask for, or is this a done deal, or what is this PowerPoint?
Okay. Madam Chair? So what we did is in the waiver renewal process is we signaled to USDOE that we had an intention of working on an assessment accountability pilot, that we would be working with the state board, seeing what legislation passed this session, and then coming back through the amendment process to request some type of waiver or some type of pilot project that the state could move forward on. So we signaled it's inside of the submission that we sent that we wanted to explore this idea, but the meat of it is not inside of that proposal. That has to be developed and submitted.
So these slides were not in that request or suggestion?
Madam Chair? No, you're correct. They're not inside of that.
So as we talk about what is inside of that request, when does that get approved, discussed, or put into a presentation? You know, in a month, in a week?
Are you talking about this presentation?
I'm saying when does the guts of the waiver happen? When do we develop that? When does it get submitted to the USD?
Madam Chair? So just to be, try to help clarify, if the state board wants to move forward with a pilot project for the state of Colorado, that would be an amendment to an approved waiver. So we would work on an amendment. The waiver renewal has been submitted to USDOE.
But the content of what it is, we're working on.
The content of the possible amendment has not been submitted. That's
Thank
correct.
You. Yeah. I like detail.
Yeah, does that,
My
does
question,
that help?
Okay. Can I ask a question? So I'm just looking at slide 9, which is the potential pilot assessment plan, which I think you've said you signaled to the USD that Colorado wanted to propose something like that, right? So when we look at this slide, my concern is, does this actually propose more assessment? Because when I look across ELA, math and science, PARC or CMAS is given every year at every grade in at least one area, and the only grade that it's not is in sixth grade, and then it's replaced with local assessments, common tasks, CBA, or curriculum-based college readiness and so forth. I mean, really, to develop good common tasks that follow the guardrails, which, again, I'd like to read the actual documents that talk about what can we ask for, right? To me, if you're going to really come up with common tasks that fulfill the requirements of these guardrails, we're going to actually have more assessment, and we're going to have a lot more discussion around how to create common tasks that are, in fact, common, standardized, comparable. I mean, in some ways, I think we've actually created a lot more work, and we certainly haven't uncoupled from PARC. So I just think we should have a deep discussion about what are the real guardrails based on the actual language in the statute, and what are the implications of the pilot assessment plan, and so forth. I mean, I think just coming up with tasks that, what did you call it, authentic tasks or something? Student
student learning tasks or something that are meaningful. I mean, that is a huge undertaking, as you know. You know, create a Lego project for kids looking at, you know, volume and area and perimeter and all this kind of stuff where you actually have rubrics and steps. I mean, I'm just saying there's a ton of work inside slide 9. And if we're looking for economies of effort and reduction of assessment, I'm not sure we've purchased much for ourselves except more assessment.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
Great question, Dr. Scheffel. What I was trying to illustrate here, and it sounds like I didn't do a great job, was some of what you heard from our presenters earlier. In some sense, they said several times, we're not asking for less assessment, we're probably asking for more, but more meaningful. So when it says local assessments, these might be pieces they already have that they want to use. And we're trying to find some way to find space in an accountability system that's driven by one single measure now to reduce that emphasis so there's less of that. And they can bring these assessments that are useful to them, that are useful in their particular locale and important to the district. So I understand your point here. Part of this would be talking about how such a system might come together. You're probably going to have some checks with a large-scale assessment in some of these pieces to accommodate comparability, but there are ways you can try to minimize the impact of that state test so that the assessments they give are the ones that they value.
And so I just want to make a comment. As we ask for a waiver, as we look to the USD to ask for more flexibility, less top-down, less centralization, I want to make sure that inside that waiver is not actually asking for more. I mean, I heard the district saying they want more, but they're driving what they want, not the state. This is state-driven, these common assessments. And to really come up with common assessments that are state-driven will actually multiply our efforts in assessment exponentially based on that slide, if I understand.
Madam Chair? Madam Chair? I think Dr. Scheffel's bringing up a great point, and I think that's really the issue at hand with the federal law and the state law that we have to navigate is under NCLB and then under the waiver process of NCLB, to try to get away from the annual assessment requirements of NCLB, USDOE has signaled that they're not willing to do that even through these pilot projects. So the pilot projects, like for New Hampshire, yes, they actually are requiring in many ways more assessments than what are currently in order to get comparability. And so USDOE is going to want comparability before they kind of let go of the reins around the annual assessment requirements. At least that's what they've signaled, and that's what they've told us. Now, if ESEA is reauthorized, some of the earlier versions of ESEA give states some of that flexibility to make those decisions. So what the school districts that came today are requesting and what state legislatures can do, I think, is provide some of that flexibility. But even if you got USDOE to signal that they would be willing to do less around annual assessments, you'd still have to come back to the state requirements of annual assessments, and you'd have to have the state legislature remove those requirements. So, I mean, you've got a pretty difficult path to get away from annual assessments in the short term, I think.
And that's why I'm raising the issue, because as this language goes out to the USD, and we're looking at a PowerPoint with just bulleted language, I would like to meet with staff and figure out exactly what's in that waiver, because actually we may be doing ourselves harm as a state if, in fact, we're looking for economies of effort. We may not get that at all. We may be multiplying the efforts. Thank you.
And I would agree with you, Deb, and I have just been informed we really need to move along. We've got some people. So unless you have a vital question, can we move out of Elliott?
It's not a question.
Can we release
Elliott? Response to Deb. They asked to be able to use formative assessments because those are more valuable. They didn't ask to use less, and that's a discussion I agree with you. That's a discussion we have to have.
And I think I agree with that too. That it's a good discussion you need to have.
I don't think I want to let that go. I've met with these people individually, and if anybody thinks they're asking for more assessments, believe me, they're drowning in the assessments they have now. So let's not walk away with this idea that they want more assessments.
That's what they said.
No, it's not what they said.
They want more meaningful assessments.
They want, they recognize there'll be more assessments.
They don't want more assessments under any circumstances.
They said there would be more. Madam Chair.
No, I'm going to use my executive privilege, and thank you, Dr.
and we'll move on to the next. And we can have that. We will have more and more time to yell at each other. Okay? We are now moving ahead to the next section, 402, Elementary and Secondary Education, ESEA, Flexibility Waiver Renewal Update, which is probably more of the same, right, Dr. Owen?
Yes.
You may even get your chance.
You probably get it done.
Madam Chair?
Yes, please go ahead.
Okay, so we were able to actually cover some of the information earlier, so I'll try to be as brief as possible. Just a quick reminder, and Pat, if you can move those forward for me, that'd be great. In March, we met with the State Board to discuss our current waiver to NCLB, ESEA, and talk to you about some potential amendments that we were requesting on our current waiver. And we submitted that, and then we also talked to you about submitting our waiver renewal for the next 3 years, which we worked with you on and got approval for that and got that submitted. So this is a quick update on a letter that we forwarded to you about 2 weeks ago from USDOE that indicated information on our request and the status of those requests. So today, really what we're going to talk about is our current waiver that expires at the end of this school year into June. We have not got any additional information yet from USDOE on our waiver renewal request, which is the 3-year renewal, okay?
And what did we, remind me, what we waived from?
Madam Chair, yes. The renewal is a waiver from No Child Left Behind, okay? So, Pat, can you go to slide 3? These are the 4 main bullets that are on the waiver submission that we sent for our current amendments to the existing waiver that we have with USDOE. So we requested that students that take high school math courses in the middle school levels, that they don't be required to be double tested. So if a student's in accelerated math and they take like a 9th grade math assessment in 8th grade, then they don't have to take that same assessment in 9th grade. And that was just kind of working with USDOE to get that approved, and that was taken care of. Students participating in field testing of 3rd and 4th grade Spanish language assessments, we wanted to also request that they not be double tested, and with some conditions we were able to get that approved. Districts having the flexibility of weighting student growth, portion of the state educator evaluation system, we requested some information around that. USDOE signaled that they're willing to work with us on that. We've got some additional information to submit to them to get that taken care of. The last one that I think is most of interest to you was the discussion that we had with you around not the department not holding districts and schools liable for parent refusals. So we had a chance to get that information. Pat, if you can move to slide 7. We wanted to talk with USDOE about how that would work. And on the surface, what we submitted in the on the directive that the State Board, the motion the State Board passed on, not holding schools and districts liable for parent refusals, they didn't accept it in the way that it was presented. But we do want to talk with you a little bit more about what we've learned from some other states and how they're navigating this request and what we maybe can keep talking with USDOE about. So, for example, Utah passed some state legislation that allowed for students and parents to refuse to take the state test, for parents to sign off on a refusal. And they still have been able to navigate that requirement with USDOE in a way that was satisfactory to USDOE. They have to impose some federal consequences under NCLB to those schools and districts that drop below the 95% threshold. It's in the classification systems that were laid out in NCLB. But they do not hold them for the state portion accountable for the consequences for parent refusals. So we'd like to spend a little bit more time trying to figure out exactly what Utah did with USDOE and come back to you and talk to you a little bit more in June about what we've learned and whether USDOE can also provide information to us about the conditions that they placed on Utah to get that approved. And so the last slide I would just briefly mention when we take questions is that, again, we're waiting to hear about our waiver renewal application. They've indicated to us that we should expect a response in the next 4 to 8 weeks. And with that, Madam Chair, we're happy to take any questions you might have.
I'll ask you a quick question first this time. Wasn't there several pieces of legislation that came about that addressed that, but none of them actually passed? Would that be correct?
Madam Chair.
About parent refusal being okay. I think there was some legislation on that, but it didn't go anywhere.
Madam Chair, yeah, that is correct. There was a specific bill around it that didn't end up getting making its way through. But there was some language that was added to the last kind of compromise bill that was finally decided on that does allow for or requires school districts to have some conditions around refusals and the way they approach them. And so we're going to make sure we include that in the language that we use and talk to USDOE about.
Okay, thank you. Board?
What?
No questions?
I have a question.
I was going to say you better escape quick.
Remind me what we voted for yesterday, Board. I mean, we voted on the waivers, and there were two votes. Was one the opt-out, and how does this request not holding districts and schools liable for parent refusals relate to that, or doesn't it relate to it? I'm trying to pull up the exact kind.
Madam Chair, my recollection of what you voted on yesterday did not include the motion that you passed around not holding districts and schools liable. So from my recollection, and anybody can correct me as well, that's still in place, and that's what we're operating off of. So you did not take any action to reverse that decision that the board made.
So this is consistent with that. We haven't heard from them yet.
Madam
this
Chair.
Request is consistent with not having rescinded that resolution.
Right? Yeah.
I know, but this is consistent with what with what is still in place that we spoke to parent refusals regarding, right?
Madam Chair.
Yes.
Yeah, we are still trying to get the board's will work through the federal system. And trying to work with USDOE, and we'll continue to do that, and then we'll continue to update you on our progress and the conversations that we have with the department.
Okay, thank you.
Yep.
Thank you.
Yeah. Thank you.
You get off easy. Oh. Who are you pointing at? House. Oh. Okay, very good. We got through that in record time. Item number 501, change request for fiscal year 2016-17 budget, 15 minutes. And Jim, and Leanne, where there she is. Change request for the fiscal year.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yes. Good morning. Nice to see you all. The good news is this is the fewest change requests we've made this century, so it should go quickly. If you could turn to your handout or in your packet, the handout entitled Fiscal Year 2016-17 Budget Change Requests, I will briefly walk you through the three items we have. The three of them are total program, categorical programs, and preschool in-service training plan. The first two items on your list are annual requests that the department is required to submit to the General Assembly. Total program primarily provides adjustments to state share and local share based on changes in student count, collections of local taxes, things like that. And the categoricals are increased annually by inflation, and this request primarily allocates that increase across the 8 categorical programs in statute. So the last one is the department-initiated request, which is the preschool in-service training plan. And this request is to obtain spending authority for some funding that was deposited in the public education fund. This fund and a tax checkoff were created by Senate Bill 11109 to provide funding to the Colorado Preschool Plan. And to date, that checkoff has raised $72,000 that we're now requesting to use for professional development around best practices in early literacy and early mathematics instruction. Really, the plan has three components. It's the training itself. There will be regional trainings conducted around the state. There will be materials provided at the trainings, but there will also be toolkits and things like that developed to disseminate to districts and preschool programs around the state. And then the last piece of that will be the CPP team coming out to provide some technical support to at least 20 districts around that training. And I hope I can catch you up a little bit, Madam Chair, because that's all I've got.
Doesn't sound like there's a whole lot of choice there. Any questions? Gee, you got off easy, didn't you?
Well, thank you.
We'll wait for it.
Bring these back again.
Excuse me, Madam Chair. I did.
Go ahead, Pam.
So it looks very clear. These are funds that taxpayers check off for the Colorado preschool program, but it's someone's choice to decide to use them for training.
Yes.
I mean, who decides that? And
yeah,
thank you, Madam Chair.
Is that the best use of these funds?
Well, I won't make that value judgment, but the department has elected to use the funds in the fashion that you see in the – it's actually Attachment A3 that will give you a little more detail about that. But yes, this is what we determined was the best use of those funds.
Can anyone elaborate on that?
Madam Chair? Sure. So when staff looked at the amount, since it's not a large amount, I think originally if there had been a large checkoff and a lot had been deposited to that fund, our hope would be to disseminate it out to the preschool programs themselves. But the number of preschool programs to disseminate it would be pennies, kind of a thing. So we were looking at where the preschools have been asking for some support, and it was particularly around the early literacy and math numeracy work, which then also flows to other state objectives around improving literacy skills and numeracy. So it was to provide training and supports of areas that our preschool facilities have asked for additional assistance.
Yeah, forgive me. What is a CPP provider? Classrooms?
Yeah.
I'm sure. So Colorado Preschool Program is what that stands for, and it's anyone who's receiving funds to provide that program. And those are disseminated to districts, and then districts determine who are their preschool program providers.
So this is a voluntary tax that people check off when they do their taxes, is that right? And they contribute funds, and the funds can be used for a variety of things, or what is the stipulation for those funds, just preschool?
Madam Chair, the statute is specific to the funds being checked off for use in the Colorado Preschool Program.
So it is specific to that?
Yes.
So is this a kind of a detail just saying, okay, that's what it's stipulated for, so now we request spending authority of the money, or is there something else it could be used for?
Yeah.
Thank you, Madam Chair. There are a variety, I don't quote me on the number, but there are a certain number of tax checkoffs that can be included on the tax form each year. I believe they're limited to a certain number of years if they don't receive contributions of a certain amount, things like that. But I think you can have 12 on the tax checkoff form or on the personal income tax form each year. Special Olympics is often one. There are a variety. Natural Resources generally has one. And the CPP is specific in the sense that it's specific on the tax form, but there are actually a variety of checkoffs that people see when they complete their
taxes. That are tied to specific initiatives.
Correct.
And this is tied to the Colorado Preschool Project program. Okay, thank you.
Any other questions?
Yeah.
Yes, ma'am.
So just technically, this $72,000, is that from last year? Or is that just since April 15th of this year? Yes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. That actually goes back to the 2011 tax year.
It's 11?
Yes, ma'am.
Oh, swift. No. So this number may be different year after year. Is this the first time we've approved it?
This is the first time we have made the request. It's been on the form. It was renewed, I believe, in 2013. But this is the first year we've obtained the balance of the fund and requested spending authority.
So I'm wondering if I could make a request for some follow-up after we do these three things. Have some kind of a measure that tells us this was seen by our providers or by our school district. I mean, I want you, whoever's making this decision on how to spend it, make some expected outcomes so that, assuming this comes back next, that we have some funds next year.
Evaluation.
Just some kind of an evaluation, not that's going to kill everybody, but that makes us, makes folks think about whether this is a, was the best choice versus some other alternative, because it sounds like you had some choices, and I'd like some follow-up, please.
Yes, sir. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
This enlightening presentation.
I'll look at my tax returns.
Back to order.
Oh.
We have a couple of those really good things that we do here on the board. May I?
Go. Oh, we're missing somebody.
No, we're not waiting. I was waiting for people to quit talking. We have a couple of awards now, both the Highly Effective School Library Program Award and the Online and Blended Educator Recognitions. Commissioner?
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. As we've done in the past, we really want to recognize our libraries. I'm going to turn this over to our state librarian, Gene Hainer, and his staff as we begin the presentation. The awardees today. That will also involve them coming up forward and getting pictures, I understand. Thank you.
Thank you. Go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Board, and Commissioner. And by the way, Commissioner, you are the state librarian. Read the statute.
I'm a lot of things.
call it a field promotion. I'm honored to be here today and appreciate your time in us honoring the highly effective school library programs for this year, 2015. Each of the schools being honored today has demonstrated many innovative ideas for improving learning, and they represent some of the best practices of libraries in the state. They do such thing as collaboration with school staff and integrating 21st century skills into the classroom content. We recognize these schools because of ongoing research in Colorado and across the country that says there's a correlation between what goes on in the school library and assessment scores. And the practices that these libraries bring to you today is exemplary models of that practice. They are selected through a rigorous process, competitive process, and selected by a 16-member peer review collaborative group in the state. And the application asks them to meet the criteria in our highly effective school library program rubric, which are guidelines describing what a quality, high-quality program is. As an example of the effectiveness of this, we just learned this morning that one of the awardees from last year has just been named the American Association of School Librarians Collaborative Program of the Year.
Wow.
So not to take the thunder from this year's group, but the success travels.
We expect the same, right?
So I'll now turn this over. And by the way, the school was Sierra Middle School in Parker with Stephanie Maurer and Jennifer Milstead from last year's group as the honorees. So I'll now turn it over to Becky Russell, our consultant with School Library Program, and she will talk to you more about the implementation.
Thank you, Gene. Thank you, Board Chair and State Board members and Commissioner Hammond. If you ask your average person on the street about a librarian, such stereotypes as "I love books," or "shh," or "the person who gets us stuff," are what typically emerge. These teacher library leaders shift what at one time was the supportive aspect of the librarian's role, and they exemplify the definition of a teacher leader. In your three-page packet in front of you, we have provided you with a list of the highly effective school library program